This is the Chochmat Nashim podcast on JewishCoffeeHouse.com, because Judaism is better when women are heard. Now, here are Rachel Stomel, Anne Gordon, and Shoshana Keats-Jaskal.
Hello, and welcome back to the Chochmat Nashim podcast. I'm Anne Gordon, here today with
Shoshana Keats-Jaskal
and Rachel Stomel.
We're here with our Ask Me Anything annual episode. Most of these questions were provided in advance. Some of them may appear as we go. We have been reflecting on this past year. It did not end as it began. Our expectations were, not just our expectations, everybody's expectations were completely thrown for the most massive loop I think we can, you know, reflect on in modern history. And I know that you all share that perspective with me. As you'll hear as we go, we went back to our first episode where we talked about some wishes and dreams for the coming year. And some of them became quite poignant and or morbid, humorous. I'm not sure. A whole different range of reactions to this very, very difficult year of pandemic. That said, the situation of Judaism and women in Judaism and the Jewish community and what we can do to make sure that we leave our world better than we found it continues apace. And we are here to answer your questions and discuss exactly some of these questions of how we relate to women in Judaism, the Jewish world, orthodoxy, and modernity. Before we get to any of those questions, however, we have a troll for you and for your goon.
And this troll does not disappoint. Here it goes, quote, "Your whole profile is based on rechilut," which is another word for gossip, basically. "Blaming all men. Maybe we should have a pogrom. You are ridiculous."
So nice.
Every time I read it, I can't get over it. Okay, and we have our Firgun. Regarding a magazine with a policy to erase images of women and girls, quote, "I was able to convince my mom to end the subscription, and we called them and told them why. Thank you for all the work you do. Here's to a future where there is change of such misogynistic policies."
Amen.
Our first question, do you think you have an impact on the most ultra of the ultra-Orthodox groups? As an ex-ultra-Orthodox person, I feel like I have none, and like things aren't changing. And if they are, it's for the worse.
I'll start. I think that, whether we like it or not, the most ultra of the ultra-Orthodox groups, I'm going to wager, have no idea that we exist. But I think that that would be true without Chochmat Nashim. I'm not sure that there's an awareness in the most ultra of ultra-Orthodox groups that there is a religious stripe called modern Orthodoxy, centrist Orthodoxy, etc. When we find ourselves encountering the yeshivish world, I would say, or maybe some people would call it modern Haredi, right? There's all these very fine-tuned stripes within the Orthodox world. I think that there is a wide range of interaction that does take place, and not necessarily where I myself might see it. It's not necessarily happening at my Shabbat table, but it might be happening on Instagram. It might be happening via somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody who heard the podcast. And therefore, we expand our conversation in ways that we don't quite ever realize that it's going to happen. We have not set out to change the ultra-Orthodox world. It is not our bailiwick. We know that that's not exactly where we stand, and it's presumably a totally unfair enterprise if that were to have been our goal. To say that we have no connection to it would also be false, because obviously there's, as we've been discussing now for years, there's far more seepage, I would say, from one element of the Orthodox world to the next element of the Orthodox world. And that means that modernity is affected by the more Haredi and the more Hasidic. And they, in turn, certainly have some reaction to us here in the more modern world. And I would also say that whether it's worse, I think that is the spiral of the world right now feels that a lot of things get worse, I think. And I don't think that that's a matter of specifics within what anybody is trying to accomplish within Orthodoxy. I think that things have been sliding towards extremism because that seems to be the nature of humanity right now, and we are trying to stem that tide. I think that there are ways that we are doing so, including some people, as we keep saying, you know, some people do tell us that we are helping them. So the fact that our questioner here feels otherwise is painful. And I hope that in due time we can all, you know, come to improve.
I think I'm going to address the question that is maybe behind this question, which basically I think there's a little bit of an assumption here that if you want to make change within Judaism, then you have to aim for changing, you know, the most, you know, extreme, and then everyone else will kind of follow suit. There's also a tendency sometimes that we have of looking over our right shoulder to see, you know, where they are so that we can know where we are. And I don't necessarily know if that's an accurate way to make change or if it's even, you know, like Anne said, if that's even one of our goals. So, you know, also like Anne said, there definitely is a dialogue that's happening, whether even if it's not an actual dialogue of people talking to each other. Often that doesn't happen as much as it should, but there definitely is a overlap. And, you know, I think the word you used was seepage, and of, you know, of things moving from one camp to the other or one group to the other. And especially in Israel, where we are all, you know, living on top of each other. Everyone is connected to everyone. The government, you know, and politics, everything is so intertwined between different groups. And also you see, especially, you know, with government things, you see alliances between people that you would not have expected because that's just the way politics work. You'll see, like, you know, the ultra-Orthodox parties aligning with, you know, Dafka the, I don't know, like the Arab parties about something that they, you know, that something that affects both of their sectors. And you wouldn't, you know, necessarily think of different groups as, you know, natural bedfellows, but that's what ends up happening. So I think that things are changing and we can't always predict how they will be changing. But I am to assume that the way that we can get change happening in Orthodoxy or in Judaism as a whole is by looking towards the more extreme or fringe aspects of it is not necessarily what's effective or what we should even be aiming for.
Okay. Next question. Is it important that my boyfriend also support causes like Chochmat Nashim? He doesn't seem as interested. Meaning, I assume he doesn't seem as interested as the questioner herself.
I love this question. This means that part of a relationship, people are thinking about, does this person feel the same way about the things that I find that are important, the things that I care about, the things I want to raise my children towards. And so I have two different answers. One is a wife who definitely has different interests than her husband, and one as someone who believes that organizations such as Chochmat Nashim are super important. Like, on the one hand, if you don't like your boyfriend's ska music or two-hour jazz jams, then it doesn't really matter as long as you're not throwing things at him when he's playing them. But on the other hand, if these are the things that represent you and your life and what you are passionate about and how you want to raise your children, and it's not that he just doesn't like Shoshana Kitschaskel, but rather he doesn't like the ideas that Chochmat Nashim and other organizations stand for, such as women having voices, women being heard, women being part of policy decision and having influence in the community. So that is a different question. And that's something you should be discussing, certainly beyond the scope of organizations that you like and the types of things and ways that you want to see your family or your community evolve or become into. And I would say, do your best to do it without, you know, any sort of accusation or anger, because sometimes these things are just not on other people's radar. If it doesn't affect them, they don't necessarily feel it. They don't necessarily understand why it's important. And a lot of what we do is explaining why things are important. So one of the nicer ways maybe is to sit and have a glass of wine and listen to the podcast together and say, you know, I was thinking about this specific issue. What do you think about it, without turning it into, well, if you don't feel the same way I do, then we don't have a future together. It's really important to be able to discuss things that you may not see eye to eye on, because eventually that's part of growth and part of a relationship is hearing and understanding one another, even if you don't exactly agree or understand the person's specific perspective.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And I think that I would have probably given a different answer maybe when I was like 18 versus now. I think that, you know, over the years, I've realized that there are a lot of things that even if I, you know, let's say I was dating a version of myself years ago, I'd be like, what is this person? And she doesn't understand these things. And, you know, it's not because I inherently was a bad person. I just had different experiences and different things I'd been exposed to. And my own evolution over the years has really given me a different perspective on life and really sharpened a lot of my opinions on things. And so for me to assume that, you know, any partner of mine should be immediately in the same place that I am automatically is not really realistic and also not really healthy. I think it's good, you know, in a relationship to have people who don't see eye to eye on certain things and also can challenge each other, you know, which helps you, you know, hash things out. But the most important thing, I think, is to be with someone who is comfortable with you having questions and comfortable with you asking questions to each other. Like if you feel that, you know, you can't bring up a topic because it'll cause so much strife that it'll just blow up, so you just don't talk about certain things, that I think is a problem and a red flag. So, you know, so the questioner, if you know, you're saying that, is it important that he supports the same things as you? I don't necessarily think that's important. What I do think is important is to be able to communicate about them, the ability to talk to each other openly, and also to make mistakes with each other, to be able to have an idea and then change your mind without feeling like they're going to be, oh, got you, you know, like just to be open and explore ideas together. Because also where you are right now for sure is going to change. You know, you are also going to change your opinion on things millions of times, and you're going to be with someone who also changes their opinions millions of times, and to be able to live with that with each other is the most important thing.
Okay, this one comes from Twitter. What is your real agenda?
So I love this question because, first of all, it comes from someone who's asking it facetiously. But the reason why she's asking it in this way is because this is something that I think a lot of people assume about women in general, especially feminists, that there is some nefarious plot that no one's telling you about, but secretly we're all trying to, like, overtake something or cause the downfall of men, and we have this, like, secret real agenda that we're not telling you all about.
Shh, don't say anything more.
Exactly. I just love that because it's not actually a question, it's just a reflection on the stupid things that we have to counter just because we're women, you know, existing in the world.
I actually wrote a blog post because of all this happening a few years ago. I wrote, yes, I have an agenda. And so now whenever anyone says, but you have an agenda, I just send them the link to the yes, I have an agenda, and actually get a lot of positive responses because obviously I have an agenda, and that's a healthy Judaism where women are seen and heard. Hello.
So our next question is, how can the FRM community advocate for change while still being seen as, quote, authentic Torah Judaism?
So I find this question fascinating because it presumes that an authentic Torah Judaism is exactly our society as we have it in its ideal, right? Because otherwise there would be nothing to change, right? How can we advocate for change and also be an authentic Torah Judaism? It must be that the world as we have it is perfect.
And static.
I mean, I don't know if we can keep it perfect in this exact way, right? Static, it didn't strike me as part of the question. But what I find fascinating is this presumption that what we have now, meaning that which should not be changed because it is authentic Torah Judaism, is in fact what authentic Torah Judaism is supposed to be. And it strikes me that my world, my experience of the world, but also the world that I see, including what I believe to be authentic Torah Judaism and an attempt at it anyway, I think it is not perfect. And therefore, I think that this question is not, like, the first half and the second half do not contradict. There is nothing contradictory to me to see authentic Torah Judaism and an advocate for change in the FRM community to make sure that our FRM community better resembles what we think authentic Torah Judaism is supposed to represent. And so on the one hand, that sounds tautological and, well, you know, we're not perfect, so therefore we must have work to do. And the answer, I think, is yes, we have work to do. If you want to see an authentic Torah Judaism lived, then that means no oppression, right? That the ger should be treated well, the convert should be treated well, the orphans and the widows. So let's just stop there, right? Meaning these are the people, the underdogs of society, according to the Torah, were cautioned to make sure to take care of the ger 36 different times. And yet we have issues in some of these categories, right? So I think that there's no contradiction. Not only is there no contradiction between, you know, what does it mean to have authentic Torah Judaism and what does it mean to have change of the community, but in fact, in order to live an authentic Torah Judaism, we must advocate for change in the community so that we can bring that to fruition. We are not there. And the presumption of this question that we are, again, I find it remarkable. I find it a little bit presumptuous and a little bit disturbing. I understand that part of this question is, you know, how much are we, Chochmat Nashim, trying to push the envelope to something that isn't authentic Torah Judaism? But as Shoshana said before, in terms of our agenda really is, I believe, authentic Torah Judaism to the best that our community can live up to it. And we have a ways to go.
The next question. Do we always need to find a halachic precedent for contemporary social issues? Should the Frum community have any other value system to rely on, such as other aspects of Torah, modern ideas of rights, democracy, etc.? Why must the first reaction to any social issue in the Frum world be, what is the halacha? And maybe only afterwards then reflect on the moral or theological component.
So this, I think, is a bit of a extension maybe from the question that you just answered, Dan. And it was funny, this morning and I was scrolling through Facebook and I saw, you know, some, I don't remember where it was from, and it was a question about, is there a halachic basis for vegetarianism? And it reminds me of this question because it seems like there are a lot of ideas that can exist in the world that are good moral ideas. Full disclosure, I'm not vegetarian, but I think I would like to be one ideologically, if I were intellectually honest with myself. So there are these, you know, good ideas that are out there in the world that aren't necessarily sourced directly in Judaism, but they still have merit. And I don't think that we should relate to these things as threatening. And I also don't think we should always say, just because it comes from quote-unquote the outside, it doesn't have merit, or it's outside idea, it's Hellenism or whatever other things that people like to throw around. We have a concept of, you know, chokhmah begoyim tamim, that if there is wise ideas with merit that come from outside, you know, the Jewish world, you should still believe them. You know, like, for example, just something as simple as physics. You know, like, there are very good ideas that aren't necessarily based in the Torah.
I love that you just called physics simple.
Well, maybe not simple to me, but to some people. And I meant that something that is not, you know, necessarily, you know, morally or ideologically charged.
It's not ambiguous.
It's, you know, it's a system that, yeah, it's something that you know, it's a system that exists outside of Judaism and doesn't necessarily threaten anything that we're doing. It's not like, let's say, a different religion, for example. As a religious people, and the, you know, being that the world we live in is heavily based on Torah and halacha and all these things that we think about all the time, it's natural for us to relate everything to ourselves and to our own framework of how we think about things. So we think, oh, you know, is this good for the Jews? Or what does halacha think about this? Or whatever. And I think that's normal and natural, but it shouldn't be a disqualifying factor for ideas that are not sourced directly from the Jewish corpus of whatever. And we should, you know, be more open to exploring these other things without feeling guilty about them and without feeling like we have to say, oh, this is based on Torah because X, Y, and Z. Like, no, it's okay if it's not.
I would even argue that a lot of the things that people don't think are sourced in Torah are very much sourced in Torah, like even vegetarianism. Adam and Chava were created not eating meat, not eating animals. We didn't get the right to eat animals until after Noach, after the flood, rather. So I actually think Dafka vegetarianism, and my daughter, who is a vegetarian, likes to tell me that, Dafka was the ideal, right, that we don't eat animals.
Well, Rav Kook has a whole, you know, answer about
Nachon, about sacrifices and korbanot and what's it going to be, yeah, and how are we going to relate to 100%. I think this goes back to the other question, like about authentic Torah Judaism. Well, okay, but who's to say that was specifically authentic Torah Judaism because it was done at the time doesn't mean it was specifically the ideal to be done at the time. And I would just say that morals in general, ethics in general, are all part of the system that God gave us to say, be a good person, right? Like, I like to just say, be a mensch, you know. Hillel said it, but, you know, whatever you is hateful to you, don't do to anyone else. And I'm just like, man, be a mensch. Just like shorten it for the attention span of 2020. But honestly, I think most things that people are going to come with, except obviously, Rachel, when you said other religions, is that makes sense. Things that you feel are moral, ethical, whatever, I would argue Dafka could be found within, just like anything on Shabbos could be put into 39 categories. I would argue it could be found in the Torah. Doesn't necessarily have to be. Doesn't necessarily have to be brought to a source and say, oh, this is the Torah source for it, so it's okay. But I would say that if someone wants to, feels comfortable with, wants to know that what they're doing isn't necessarily neged the Torah, that if they were to learn and to understand and to go back to that source of where is this coming from, is it morals, ethics, whatever, I think you would find that it is very much mat'im or working with the Torah as it was given to us.
And just to be, not really to be contrary, but to offer a contrary view, I think it's okay to premise what you're looking into as, you know, what does the Torah have to say on this? I think it's not a bad starting point. It doesn't necessarily have to be the ending point. When something is, in fact, antithetical to Torah, I think we need to know that. I don't think it's as easy to find things antithetical to Torah as some people do, right? I agree with you, Rachel. I agree with you, Shoshana. But that doesn't mean there's nothing that isn't, right? There certainly are things that are counter to Torah, and we need to struggle with them, keep away from them, whatever it is, depending on the issue. Obviously, like, it gets very, it can get very complicated.
You know, a related challenge also is that the Torah is so vast and broad, you know, not just the Torah, but Torah Shebal Peh, like the whole, you know, body of what we consider Torah is so broad. And we are such smart people that you can really almost justify anything with the Torah if you want to.
Both ways.
Something that was really interesting that I read a while ago was a bunch of these drashot that were given at the time of when slavery was about to be abolished in America. It was so interesting of reading different drashot that were given, you know, in shuls in America about why we have to keep the institution of slavery because dafka of, you know, all these halachic and Torah values, and then someone else saying exactly the opposite. And, you know, I think that that's also something we have to be very wary of, that you can do that. You know, you can take, you know, a moral idea or, you know, some social issue and try to justify it using religious arguments. And that's, it can be dangerous too.
What accomplishment are you most proud of from the last year?
All right, I'm going to actually own up to being proud of something that I've done. I can't take full credit for it. I'm going to share that credit with Dr. Yordain Asband, which is that on January 5th, which is the date that began the new Daf Yomi cycle, Yordain and I launched the podcast Talking Talmud. I've spoken about it already here on the podcast. And we have Bli Ayin Hara, Kein Yirbu. We have kept it up day in, day out, since January 5th till today. Pandemic, vacation, lack of connectivity, children, professional lives, etc.
And also a time difference. You guys are in different continents.
She is in New York. I am obviously in Jerusalem. And I can't say that every day is easy, but we have managed. And so I am proud of us for doing that. I can't even say that I have learned every daf well. I haven't learned every daf well, but I have gone through every daf, at least at the very, very bare minimum, enough to produce a reasonable short podcast on the daf. So I think the pride is in the dailiness of it, right? More than any given one episode.
Shkoyach, shkoyach. Shkoyach. I think that's a huge accomplishment. I don't think I'd be able to have done that, so good for you guys.
Thank you. I'm going to thank you on Yordain's behalf as well, and I'm sure that the fact that we're each here for the other keeps us going a bit as well. Anybody who's interested, Talking Talmud, you can find it where you find your podcast.
Where do you see the role of women in From Life going in the next few years?
Wow, this is a big question. You know, like Anne said at the beginning of the podcast, and we, you know, last year, or I guess the beginning of this year, we had all our predictions and all our hopes and aspirations for what we wanted in this coming year. And that all was like, you know, because this year was crazy and no one could have anticipated the way it went. So it's hard to look forward to the next few years and be like, oh, this is where I see things going. Because if, you know, if this year taught us anything, is that no one knows where anything is going at any given time, even, you know, when schools are opening for our kids. Also, one of the things that this pandemic has shown us is that the roles of everyone has really been changing. The way that our Jewish community is structured has been totally turned on its head, socially, especially, communally, all these things. And those are the things where women are usually the most affected, social things, communal things. And so I think it gives us pause a bit to think this is really an opportunity, I think, to, you know, rethink the way our society is structured and maybe also use it as an opportunity to make some bigger changes, you know, to throw in some things that we maybe, you know, even a year ago wouldn't have dared to do and would have thought, you know, is relevant, and just try it out. So I'm hoping that, you know, people who are listening to this, you know, women and men, can maybe take this opportunity and push the envelope a bit, as I'm always excited to do. So in the next few years, I would like to see women becoming more vocal about things. I'd also like to see, you know, as, you know, we've seen leadership roles kind of breaking down, because the way that our community is structured is no longer really led in one central place. Everything is kind of decentralized now. I think this is the perfect opportunity for men and women to step up and restructure how we run things in the community.
I think it's the Chinese word for crisis is both crisis and opportunity. And I really believe that I really believe that the pandemic has given us a real opportunity. As much as it's been utterly stunning to our religious life, I think it also brings a lot of opportunity, doors that are being opened. And I think what I would love to see is women not to wait and see what other people want them to do, ask them to do the space that they're given, but rather to make their space. I see a lot of it on Instagram. I'd love to see that come off of Instagram a little bit. That's a whole nother podcast topic, which is fascinating to me. If you look at the women influencers on Instagram with 60, 70, 100,000 followers, they have massive followers, more than most rabbis that you may know in your life. And I think women making space for themselves, growing, learning, you know, making a Talking Talmud podcast once a day, simply doing what they can, where they can, and how they can will only benefit the Jewish community. And I would love to see that more. And I'd love to hear from you guys out there listening, what you would like to see, how you feel you can talk to your community. What's your dream? You know, what do you want to do? I'd love to discuss that.
Some things seem far-fetched, but have a good chance at actually happening. For example, the adoption of the International Beit Din, incorporating women into decision-making bodies, etc. Some things won't, for example, women serving as witnesses at a wedding. How can we differentiate between the two, especially when both categories involve things that insult one's basic respect?
This is actually a really interesting question that we've spoken about in certain ways, but I'm gonna answer it the way that I see it. So I agree that there are certain things that feel like our basic respect and maybe are our basic dignity being disrespected. I certainly see the connection between not being counted for a minyan and not being counted at all in terms of having a voice, having an opinion, having influence in the community. I don't think it's a direct line, but I do think it, without question, affects who gets to say what and who's listened to. At the same time, I would say like this, the things that we can influence, at least for me, is how I make my first decision. You know, can I influence minyan? Mamashlo. Whether I want to or not, it doesn't matter. Right now, I can't influence minyan. Can I influence women being harmed by not having their health discussed? Yes. Can I influence people having prenups and postnups and potentially reducing the number of agunot, advocating for change in the Beit Din? Yes. And so for me, my first distinction is, where can I make change? Where could I potentially influence? And that would be my, you know, where do I start? And the second thing is, who's getting hurt? Now, again, some of this is a short term and some of it is a long term, like I discussed in terms of minyan. Some people may be very, very hurt by not being able to go to minyan or not being able to be a witness at a wedding. But aside from the fact that I can't influence it, I also don't see that hurt on the same level as a woman who doesn't have a get and can't move on with her life. And so without discounting the pain of the person who feels it and can't get what she needs for her own satisfaction, I also have to say, if this pain is something that is preventing someone from moving on in life and is a systemic communal issue, that's where I would start. At the same time, I would absolutely start advocating for those things that may be longer term. How can we look at this issue? Where are the boundaries of this issue? Where can we push, Rachel, as you said, the boundaries of this issue? And whom else can I work with in this space towards the change? And what's that goal? Some of this is like, you know, long-term strategy and long-term team building and collaborations, as opposed to there's someone in my community who needs help right now. I like to put things in those kinds of categories just so that I can do what I can and potentially make change and then think about how can I affect in the longer term, like articles on women learning and how actually women's learning isn't quite what people think it is, or at least was 2 years ago. And here are the facts and here's the situation and here's where you can go to learn more. So I think, again, depending on where we are, what we can do, who our resources are, that's how I would distinguish, at least for certain goals, in a nutshell. Next question. What books are you reading right now?
I can answer that one first. Dr. Chavi Eve Karkowski, who is a friend and a first-rate fetal obstetrician, wrote this book called High Risk, and it is a beautiful read. It is a poignant read. Not everybody should read it at all times of their life, especially if you're potentially a pregnant woman or recently delivered of a baby. But she has taken her work, her life's work, and put it into a readable book for anybody who is at the stage to read it. It is worth reading.
I'm reading a book called Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, and it's a letter. It's kind of like somewhere between a personal essay and a letter that he's writing to his 15-year-old son about his experience growing up as a Black boy and a Black man in America. And it is really not just eye-opening, but also the language is so beautiful that you just stop on a phrase and you're like, wow, who thought to like put these two words together? That makes you think. And I was also talking to Anne before. For me, I think when you read a really good book that has really beautiful language, it makes you also want to write yourself, because it, you know, it's not something that is, you know, creative and it stops as a finished product. It's something that opens up other people to be creative as well. And this is definitely one of those books. Every time I read it, I'm like, wow, I want to say so many things. So I would recommend it to everyone.
Okay, next question. Shoshana, this is to you. Last year, a rabbi referred to you in one of his Torah classes and intimated that you would feel that Sarah Imenu, that's from the biblical Sarah, right, was not a good Jewish woman because she stayed in the tent. How do you deal with this kind of criticism? How do you deal with it when men and rabbis criticize you without giving you a chance to respond? And would you share a response to that accusation?
This was very hard for me. I actually learned about this a day or two before I was set to fly out to the United States last year for my tour in November. And it really took me by surprise, mainly because I was hurt that someone would speak about me without giving me the chance to speak back and to say things like, you wouldn't appreciate Sarah Imenu as a good Jewish woman because she was in the tent. So I just like to say, obviously, it's nonsense to say that Jewish women are good if they're in or out of the tent. Sarah Imenu was Sarah Imenu, and she's way high up there. Nothing to do with me. But I think when people criticize you in a way that's unfair or ad hoc or, you know, not dealing with the issues that you deal with, just do your best to go back to the issue. Ask them, when it comes to the issue, what are your objections? An insult to your person is the lowest form of argument. It's not really an argument. And I've learned over the years to really do my best to put it to the side. The fact that it was a prominent rabbi was painful, but at the same time made me only more determined to get the message out there, but to make sure that I was respectful. And I did it, and it redoubled my efforts to make sure that I would avoid at all costs that type of criticism by being very careful. And on that tour, I was much more careful with my words and tried very hard to say, and I'm just making sure that this is not taken in this such and such a way. And so actually, I learned from it.
So it's Elul now, and Rosh Hashanah is coming up. We've had a doozy of a year, which no one could have predicted. What would you have done differently in the past year had you known that this is what it would be like?
So the easy, glib answers come to mind first, right? Like the kind of answer that's, you know, buy stock in toilet paper, you know, that kind of thing. I think the...
In Zoom.
Zoom, seriously. My mother keeps saying, why didn't you tell me sooner to buy stock in Zoom? Like, Ma, I told you as soon as I thought of it. I look back, I mentioned this at the beginning, and I'll mention it again now. When we had our pre-Rosh Hashanah episode, or right around Rosh Hashanah episode at the beginning of the year, and we spoke about what we looked for in the coming year. And Rachel, you and I noted this several months ago, that my comment had been a healthy year for everybody. And it makes me shake now.
You jinxed us.
It makes me shake because we couldn't, as you said, we could not have known what was coming. But Rachel, I also think about your comment from them, which you were wishing that we would have.
Our government, because we didn't have one for like, what, like almost a year? And it was crazy with like elections after elections. And actually right now they're talking about if we don't pass the budget, then the government will fall again and we might have this crazy cycle again. So who even knows?
By the time we release the episode, we will know what happened. But on today, this day, we do not yet know whether we're going to elections again, or if they're going to pass the budget, or if they're going to pass a law that will delay the need for a budget. Meaning, I feel like in some ways, as much as this has been a doozy of a year that we could never have predicted, that it has had untold hardship for so many people in so many different ways, on the other hand, I feel like we've kind of spiraled back to, in certain ways, to where we were a year ago. And I feel like what I would have done differently would have been to make sure that I could not come back to where I was a year ago, that I would be, you know, making sure that at least in a very private, personal way, but hopefully in a bigger way, that we can all kind of move forward and like the country needs a government, and you know the coronavirus needs a vaccine, and each of us needs to take our future by the horns and just plow forward.
Maybe it was also a good exercise for us, you know, last year of having these much smaller scale unknowns hanging over our head all the time. It was good practice to get us, you know, into 2020 where everything was going to be like that.
I don't know what I would have done differently last year. I hate hypothetical questions.
I would have made a dentist appointment, actually. I should have done that. And then afterwards, I was like, no.
But I will say this. I hope that this coming year that we are able to take these past, God, I don't even know how many months it's been now. 5 months?
Really? Woo! Only five?
5 months.
Really?
Wow. Five.
It feels like it's been like a whole year. Wow.
I would like to be able to take the 5 months and really see how my life changed, what lessons or practices I want to take with me when, God willing, it all goes back to normal. Because I think that as humans is super hard for us. Like, you know, we're really good in a foxhole and like we make these changes and blah, 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 blah. And then in the long term, it's so hard to remember those lessons. And so for me, I don't know about last year, but I hope that this coming year, and I writing them down, what do I want to keep in my life? Whether it's my kids staying and doing chess with their grandparents online, or whether it's making sure that my backyard is usable and nice and clean, to learning every day with my kid. I haven't done that yet, so don't let me mislead you. This is the hopefully to-do list. I hope that we can all take the positives that we've taken over the past 5 months as a community, as families, and as individuals, and try and implement them into our lives going forward. And I wish everybody a year of health and happiness and of growth and positivity.
Amen. So last year we, you know, wrapped up the season with our Ask Me Anything episode. This was another one of those Ask Me Anything episodes. And as always, if you would like to continue the conversation on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, or wherever else you can find us, not in person though, then we would love to do that with you. Take these questions, ask them to yourselves, ask them to your families, and keep the conversation going, because that's what this is really all about. So if you like this podcast, please share it with your friends, and don't forget to subscribe on all the different platforms that podcasts can be found. I'm assuming if you're listening to this, you know how to do that.
Come talk to us on our Facebook page, C-H-O-C-H-M-A-T-N-A-S-H-I-M.
Can you hear us now?